Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we're back again, and this is episode number 16. Really flying through them now. We're into February now, and it's still very cold outside.
Yeah, it's horrible, isn't it?
It's been cold for about 2 weeks so far, and it's not getting any warmer, and it's not going to get another warm for another week, so we may as well get used to it. So, but we're back, and we're ready to talk some more tech. So, what's everyone been up to?
Well, I've been doing a bit of a audit for a customer. We had to find out what sort of software they're running. We've been using might have mentioned before, Spiceworks. It's like a free bit of software which you can install on a server or a PC, and it basically it goes out and scans your network, and it finds out like what your PCs are, if you've got printers, or if you've got things like network switches and firewalls. It finds it things where you're using SNMP, and it's using, if you haven't changed anything like that from the normal public or the private SNMP, it will go and find it. And also, it can also look at Windows PCs, and you basically give it a domain admin or an administrator password, user account for that username and password, and it will basically scan that PC, and it will basically tell you like the serial number of the device, what model it is, who's the last person logged on to it, and it does all the things like the software licensing as well, so it gives you a list of all the software installed. It was quite good, but you've got to be really, you've got to that open the firewall rules on that to see the requirements are, even if you disable the firewall or if you don't disable the firewall, you need to put ICMP, so basically means that if you ping it, it replies to it. You also need to do 135 and 445 inbound. This is basically for WMI. This is where it pulls all the information from. And the UDP port 137. This is needed for Spiceworks to gather the information from the Windows registry. So that's where it pulls all the information from. But also, it's a bit of a gotcha. Even if you haven't got the firewall enabled, you have to, in the group policy, by pushing out, if it's on the domain, that you have to allow remote as administration exceptions, even if you've got the firewall disabled. It took me about half an hour, for an hour, working out why my firewall's disabled, so why can't I kind of like basically scan this machine? And it's because you need to basically allow remote administration exceptions, which basically means that an administrator can basically access that PC to do the administration and pull that information. But that's a really good bit of software for free. So also you can run a help. That's a bit of help desk software as well. So you can actually have a help desk. So the users can like log their own tickets and everything, which is quite good. So that's good. I mean, it's all free, but I'm guessing what it is that you get lots of advertising on the software. So I'm guessing that's where they make their money from. So that's kind of what I've
really good. Yeah, it does sound really good. That. Mm. I was going to say, is there any kind of limit to how many devices on the network it can do?
No, well, I scanned about 5 different sites and got about 250 devices back. So, right.
Yeah. Does it come up with any possible errors or bottlenecks or?
Yeah, it tells you about errors. Like it tells you like if the system drives low on there, or any errors in the event viewer as well. It's quite good.
Excellent. So where do you run that? You run that on the server machine.
Yeah, you install on a server, and then from there, you just tell it your subnet range, and it just scans all the devices on that network.
Do you have to put stuff on a bit of software on every machine, or does
no,
it just?
No, it doesn't. It's not an agent-based right. software.
Oh yeah. Well, that makes it a bit easier. Mm. yeah, that sounds really good, though. I like that.
What have you been up to then, Andy?
Okay, there's a couple of things. One, there's a little neat little nifty thing that you can do if anyone uses Gmail. I've had this requirement a few times now. And if you want to send an email out, like a delayed email to somebody or a group of people. So say you want to send an email out to, I don't know, 10 people at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, for example, but you're not there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to send it, then I found this little... I'll have to give you the link and we'll put it in the show notes. I've basically a little... It's like a Google... what's the Excel file called in Google? The Google Doc.
Sheets or something? Sheet.
Yeah, that's it. It's a Google Sheet, right? Which you copy into your drive somewhere. And then on that Google Sheet, you can basically specify who you want a particular email to be sent to and what time you want it to be sent at.
Mm-hmm.
I've had this quite useful to do in the last week in that. Sending emails at particular times instead of the time you send it, or delayed email, where you could send one email to one person at one time and another email at another time. So I'll put the link in the show notes for that little Google Sheet that you can download it from. Another thing we'll be doing today, and this is a bit of a mystery, and I've still got a mystery about it now. A customer on his home machine, this was about a week ago, this was going on last time, the last podcast we did last week, they said to me they had no internet. So when I got round there, pulled up Chrome Explorer or whatever, and Google came up straight away. So I thought, okay, it's working. But as soon as you tried to go to another site, it didn't work. Just for example, we went to BBC website, didn't work. I tried to go to eBay, didn't work. Where else did I try? I tried to go to the Telegraph newspaper, didn't work. So I thought, well, this is odd. Why is it going on to Google but nowhere else? Another thing that made it even stranger, it could go on to the Guardian website. And once you hit the Guardian website, it was perfectly fine. No problem with that particular site at all. So as we went on, we figured out that only certain sites were working, and most sites weren't, but certain ones were working. So, I mean, initially thought, well, I just thought it's a DNS problem. It's got to be, hasn't it, or something like that. Now, what made it more curious, because this was not a PC problem, because they had a couple of tablets and mobile phones which were connected to the wireless of that router. And we just tested this. Every website it would go to and it wouldn't go to were exactly the same on every device. There was one of the tablets they tried to go to. On the mobile phones, they all went to the Guardian website. None of them went to the BBC website. They could all go down to Google. And this was a very, very strange issue. And we eventually got BT involved when we phoned them up. And they said that there'd been an MSO in the area, major service outage. I found out what that meant. So they said that had been in the area. And since then, and this all happened at midnight on a particular night as well. It wasn't at 17 minutes past, some random time. It was bang on midnight it went off as well. They then suggested to us, well, all we can really do is change the router. They said there was something wrong with the router. Now we were using the TrendNet router, and that router had been in place for, say, 12 months. That router had been there, no problems with it. So I said, right, I'll get you another router. I was going to bring a spare one, but I didn't have a DSL spare router with me, so I ended up getting them a new router, plugging it in, getting all the settings on, connecting it, and it was exactly the same as the other router was. Exactly the same problem. Then when we phoned BT back again, and then they said that there was a problem with a VLAN in one of the telephone exchanges locally. So I said, okay, that sounds good. When they phoned the customer back to say that they'd fixed it, the problem still hadn't gone away. And then they decided to send them a BT Hub, one of those little crappy ones that they send out. We received that today, and I went round there and plugged it in, and everything worked. So now they're back online, they've got every website, everything works. So I'm a bit perplexed about what's gone wrong here, and what bit has failed.
Does the old router not work, though? If you were to plug the old router in, because it might just be a time thing. You say you plugged the BT router in today.
Yeah.
It might be working upstream of the router today, and it wasn't yesterday, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only thing that's a possibility, because the original old router doesn't work, or didn't work. The new router that we bought them didn't work, but the BT one did. That original faulty one, they said to me, he said, well, you can have that if you want. You know, he said, take it back with you, have a play with it. So I'm going to try and connect it to some other ISP at some point and see if it works.
Did you have on that router, can you set different DNS settings?
Yeah.
And were you using the same DNS servers or different DNS servers on the different routers? Do you know? Or
I tried a couple on. It's hard to remember now. Yeah. One of those had changed so many things as we were going along.
The only reason I ask is because I was having problems this nightmare mail migration that I've been on about the past couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Had real problems with because we changed the mail server, so it's changed the IP of the mail server, and what was happening was the mail clients were going to the old mail server, and that was obviously happening because the upstream server DNS servers were caching the IP for longer than they should have been, because we kept the name of the mail server the same but changed the IP, so, and it was blatantly just going to the old server for ages, for about a week or over a week. So depending on which DNS service you're using, it could definitely be a problem. And while I was Googling to try and see what might be the problem, that did come up. So maybe it's a BT DNS thing.
It could be. I mean, I was pointing it to BT the entire time. I was saying to them, it's their fault, it's nothing to do with us, it's their fault. Yeah. And there's also the conspiracy theory that since they've sent out their router, then they've fixed something.
That's what I was going to say. I've dealt with BT too much in my past, and it's always been a real problem. But I reckon there's DNS issue. I reckon that putting in that, routers put. I've had it in the past with my own ISP, when my router kind of got before I run my own little DNS server at home. If Plusnet or whatever changed their DNS server, like because what they do is they give you public IP addresses, but they just have like multiple DNS servers behind it. And if your router get confused about it, then you just get lost, or you've just that's probably where you're getting failing. And when you put the new router in, it's probably dished out different IP address or something, or different DNS servers, and that's obviously why it's working again.
Yeah. That's the only explanation. I would probably guess if I plug that supposedly broken router in,
yeah,
it, somewhere else, it will work.
Yeah. If I had tried it by putting next to it, I don't know if you tried it, it's just basically put 8.8.8.8. You know, for the DHCP server.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Instead of putting in the DHCP service, normally on the home router, the DNS server is DNS server is the router IP address. I would have just ticked little boxes, don't need like automatic, and put it into manual, and then use 8.8.8.8, and you can then cut BT out of the question completely.
Yeah, I did do that initially, but as well, they did have this major service outage, and they did have these other problems, but who knows whether they did or not. But it was very strange, but it's got to be something like that.
So,
but it's working all right today, anyway.
So what have you been up to as well then, Jerry, then? Mail servers?
Mail servers, again, but like I said, I kind of got that mail migration I was on about last week out of the way. He's getting his mail, and his employees are, so he's happy. And his dad, more importantly, I ended up... spent an hour and a half on the phone to this guy's dad trying to sort his email out. I think he was the most important customer, but yeah, got that going in the end. So I've just been looking also into DKIM and SPF records and configuration for mail servers. A lot of my freelance clients are web developers. They've got their server that they host their websites on, but they also, a lot of the time, they run it as a mail server. And more and more of the time, I'm finding that most of my time's taken up sorting out email, which I don't mind because it's, you know, I've never really dealt with email before. And it's quite interesting. I find it quite interesting watching the mail log go past and finding out what's being classed as spam and what isn't being classed as spam. But SPF records are a DNS TXT type record, and they basically say that this domain, this server or servers can send mail for this domain. So it's a way of the receiving mail server can check that mail was sent by a valid server. Now, obviously, that could be spoofed, possibly, but it's better than nothing. So the other technology that a lot of servers look at these days is DKIM, which I think I've said about in the past. It stands for Domain Keys Identified Mail, and it uses public private key crypto to not to encrypt the mail, but to verify that the mail was sent by a particular server. So if you've got a server for, say, example.com, you generate a public private key pair, and then you put the public key in another DNS record, and then when that mail is received by the mail server of the person you're sending it to, it can check that your public key, and it can verify that mail was sent by the server that said it was. It's a bit more sort of hardcore than SPF, which just says, oh yeah, this IP can send this mail, because IPs can be spoofed, host names can be spoofed, and so on. But but yeah, that's what I've been looking at. The other little tool I found was a lovely website, mail-tester.com, where you can send your emails, your test emails to this website, and it will tell you whether your SPF's in order, whether your DKIM is all set up properly. I was just really taken. It's a really nice, you know, cuddly, nice website. But it also has hardcore technical detail on it, so I quite liked it. Mail-tester.com.
Has it got a tree on it?
Yeah, it's like it's kind of like a sort of a Happy Tree Friends kind of kind of site. But yeah, it's really good. I even sent them some feedback today saying how lovely their website was.
I'd like to do a show on Linux mail servers and how to set one up, really, and how you got, was it Qmail or something you can use or whatever? Because I always get confused about the mail daemon and the things like that, and how mail gets pushed into a folder.
I'm still a little bit confused about all that myself, so I'll do a bit more research and we'll do a show in a little while, I'd say. Yeah, I'd say Postfix is the mail server that I'm. Well, it's easy to configure, easy to understand. Qmail is a bit harder, and there are others. But
is it Dovetail? A Dovetail or something?
Dovecot is a. Now that's an IMAP and POP server. So you kind of have one server, one process doing the mail transfer, the MTA, the mail transfer agent. And then you have another bit of software doing the IMAP and POP. So that's where your mail client contacts the server and asks for mail. So that kind of stores the mails on the server and handles all that side of things. So that's the something else. It's not the MUA. That's the mail user agent. That's your mail client. There's another one, another acronym that I can't remember. But yeah, that's your IMAP and POP server. So you've got Dovecot or Cyrus is another one. But yeah, I've only just touched on those really. So.
Yeah, I'd like to. Yeah, it's one of those things in Linux again is when you once you know it, and someone shows you or you research it, you understand it. But when it's scary when you start googling it and stuff, and then.
It's one of the oldest parts of the internet, if you like, email. So it's kind of people that know it really well, and someone like me is just coming to it now. You know, I've never had to admin a mail server before, but I'm starting to learn, which is good. And luckily, people are paying me for it as well, so that's good as well.
That's good. All right, I've got what on my list of things to say. I was saying about there's two things. I've got update to post layers. There's the spam filter I use before the mail hits my mail server. So my mail server isn't actually live on the internet. My mail gets routed through it first. But the problem I've got is if my mail goes out, it goes out my relay, my ISP relay. And I don't always trust that because it doesn't always get there. But post layer now do outgoing email, so I can just configure. I haven't done it yet, but I can configure my emails server to basically push my emails through post layer. And I also do the scan it. So if my server gets compromised or something, and I start sending out spam. They will kind of like outgoing spam filter, which is quite interesting.
I had a look at their website, and do you basically just set your MX record for your domain as post layer?
Yes.
Is that how it works? Because there isn't much on their website. It just says so we do this, and you know, it looks like a really good service. But you know, you kind of, I don't know. Maybe it's just me because I'm learning about it. But I kind of feel like I want to tweak it a bit more and have a bit of a dashboard there. But maybe that's just me.
Yeah, it's quite good. I can show you offline the dashboard you get with it. But I like it because I don't have to worry about putting my firewall. My mail server on the firewall on the internet. You just basically lock it down. So basically, you set your MX records to PostLayer. PostLayer then go through your email, checking all my mail. So you haven't got to worry about doing things like making sure you're an open relay or whatever. And like things like super things like when AOL emails and stuff start, if you haven't got a proper IP address or whatever like that, it gets through. And it basically then scans your email, scans your AV, and then blocks it. And then once a day you get an email saying these are the emails what are blocked, and then you can say I want to release them, or you can go and then you can look at them. Also, it's good because if your mail server goes offline or your internet goes offline, it basically it kind of like catches all your email for you, and it spools it back when your ADSL comes back up online. So it's quite. So that's quite good. So
can you use that to route your email through? So can you like have a mail server of your own that that PostLayer delivers to?
Okay. So in PostLayer, you go in and you tell it what your mail server IP address is.
Right, okay.
And then on the firewall, you basically limit your port 25 in to those IP addresses.
Yeah.
It's really good. It really works. It's basically what lots of big corporates do, like Symantec and McAfee do, but it's a lot cheaper. I think I pay like $10 a year for like it. So
yeah, that's pretty good.
And you haven't got to do your own spam filtering. You haven't got to keep all the things up to date or everything like that. It's all done it for you.
Yeah, the reason I ask that is, I mean, I might suggest that to some of my clients to save me a bit of a headache.
Yes. And you can do, yeah, it's quite interesting. You can do things like looking through what mails come in and where it's been delivered to and stuff, so it's good. The other thing that will come out this week is that Microsoft released an Outlook app for iPhones and Android, which is basically like their Microsoft Outlook product. And it basically integrates with like Office 365 and Outlook.com or your internal emails or your internal Exchange server. But it's quite odd because this Outlook app doesn't actually directly go back to your Office 365 or your Exchange server. It goes by a third-party server. So you actually, all your data is going through this third-party server, which is a bit scary because it means it's going through like the US or whatever, and then the NSA or the government can have a look at it, can't they? What all these people are scared about is, and it basically, I'll put a couple of show notes in the show notes about it, but it's quite scary really how this works really, and like obviously it stores your password or whatever. Could do in the cloud. So there's a guy who's come up with, I mentioned before, this Exchange Server Pro website, is that there's a basically a couple of PowerShell commands you can run on your Exchange Server to stop people connecting from this device. So I'll put that in the show notes. So that's really it for me this week on what I've been up to. So we had a couple of emails in, but we'll probably go over them next week. So what I wanted to talk about tonight is about virtualization. We were talking about it. I think we had an email, wasn't it, about it about a week ago about iSCSI or something. So I want to really go over it, really.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so what is virtualization? Why would you use it? Well, you've got to think these days with a service you can buy. I was looking at one with like a server the other day, which is that like each CPU had 8 cores in it, and it had 4 of these CPUs in it, so it's like 8, 16, 32 cores it could use, and then we can put loads of memory in it. And the thing is, these servers are getting so, if you just had like a set, because I like the way of, I don't know if it's what you do at work, Jerry, is that we have a server do one function each. So you have one server as a DNS server, one server as an email server, one server as a file server, so you can keep all your things separate. So if you modify one thing, it's not going to break anything else?
Yeah. Well, we try and do that, but it seems to be my employer's just getting into virtualization now, so up until now it's all been bare metal, but
yeah.
There you go.
But I mean, normally you keep your servers separate. So if you're like running loads of physical servers, you'd have like one physical server doing your email server, one physical server doing your DNS, one physical doing your file server. And you find out that if you look at the processing power of all these machines, if you have a decent machine these days, you're not even hitting the usage of it. Hitting it like 5% or something. And you think of all these servers you've got in your rack in a server room or in a data center, all that electric and power you're using, where what you can do is this brilliant bit of software called virtualization is that you can virtualize servers onto one physical hardware. So you can have a server, and then you can basically, as thinking of the best way is you could have 8 virtual servers sitting on that one physical server.
Another thing as well is, if you wanted to run 8 servers and you had to and you purchased 8 servers, how much would that cost?
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you buy one and host all 8 on the one, I mean, that's a massive sort of saving straight away, isn't there? As well as the power, electric cost, all the other bits as well, because you'll need monitors, cables, you know, lots of other things, wouldn't you? So it's a massive difference, yeah. But it's true, isn't it? These machines have got so much power, too much power just for one email server, for example.
Yeah.
So you may as well make use of the rest of it.
So the other thing, cooling as well, if you've got all these servers as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And the good thing about also these old servers, if you get thinking about servers what are 5-10 years old, which maybe a bit of software you can't basically physically move anymore because the people aren't there, you can do a thing called you can virtualize the software, but we can go on to that later on. So we basically, if you've got a server of old racks and you can't convert the software, or you haven't got the supplies to move the software across, you can virtualize them, and so you can get rid of all those servers and save money that way. So it's kind of, the good things about virtualization is one I like is that it's quick to reboot a server, because like things would go, when you reboot your server, if it's hardware, it takes ages to boot up. Whereas if it's virtual, it literally takes, I've had servers like reboot in 10 seconds. It's just like amazing.
Yeah, I've noticed that. You know, just coming onto virtualization now, it's pretty handy if you need to reboot something.
Yeah. It's because they just like VMware, we'll go on to what VMware is a little while, but they've designed it to make it as fast as possible, which is good. Another thing is high availability. So let's say you want to take a server down for maintenance of a hard drive. Sorry, you have a motherboard failure or something, a memory failure or something, and you've got multiple of these servers, physical servers, a bare bone, you can move the software, move the virtual machines around between one server to another, and then you can just take that server down, and then you can, and the servers can stay up. So it's quite interesting. I'll go on to that in a bit further, but that's another thing, is maintenance windows. And the also as well is that because it's so it's basically what's happening is you're basically virtualizing the hardware. So the virtualization software on the actual physical hardware is virtualizing the memory and the CPU and the disk controller. And basically, it's got a virtual hard drive. So like the hard drive is a file. So it's brilliant. So if you've got to do a backup or whatever, or just take a copy of something before you do a major bit of work, you could shut down the server and copy that VHD, and you've got a backup of your server before it was edited, before you did any work. And also, as well, if you want to, it's good, because if you ever have to move to another bit of hardware, let's say like intent 5, so like if you're like a small customer or whatever, and you've got, we've got a number of these at our sites where we've got using Hyper-V, where you've got Hyper-V and you've got three VMs. If that hardware gets ages, all you need to do is give Sam a new machine, shut the VMs down, copy the virtual machine files and the VHDs across, which is a virtual hard drive, to the new server, and then you just add them in back into the Hyper-V, and then you boot the server up, because it's all virtualized or hardware. There's no mismatching, because it's all done virtualized, which is kind of a nice thing about virtual.
You don't have to bother with drivers and stuff like that, then, do you? Or it's reinstalling or. I suppose those VHDs can vary in size, can't they? But but nevertheless, it's an awful lot quicker to copy a 20 gig VHD than it is to, build a server, build it up from scratch.
Yeah, so a lot of things like VHDs, you thin provision them, so they're not. So if you have like an 80 gig VHD, the white space isn't. It's not put into that file. So let's say you put Windows 2012 and it's 12 gig, that file will be 12 gig to start off with. And as soon as you start putting data in, the drive will slowly start expanding, and the file won't be 80 gig. It will be 12 gig, and if you see what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's all zeros basically on the hard drive. So it's what they call a sparse file in Linux and Unix.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
So what you get is that I was talking about this virtualization, is this virtualization layer. There's a thing called Type 1 and Type 2 hypervisor. What I'll do is I'll type one is what you would call is what you call VMware. So VMware is like the major player in it. He kind of really came up with the technology, and basically it's like a Linux. It was a Linux server, but they basically made it into their own kind of operating system. And he basically has really small footprint. It basically sits on an SD card, about a 4 giga SD card. So you haven't got to have. You can have it on a hard drive if you want, but you basically install the software, and it's just really light footprint. And what that means is a hypervisor, type 1 hypervisor, is it? That the virtualization there gives direct access to the VMs, direct access to the hardware. So there's no kind of OS kind of thing interfering with the giving memory to the server. It's all very, very, very lightweight. And I've heard me talk about Hyper-V as well, which is basically like an OS. Which is basically the Microsoft version. Okay, back to a minute, but so you get Type 2, which is basically like the software which you can, if you've got a Mac or a PC or a Linux box, you can put in like things like VirtualBox or VMware Player, which is basically like a bit of software you actually install on your PC or your whatever it is, and that then emulates the actual hard drive and the actual processor. And it's actually running a program on your machine. And then you can install the software, install the VMs you want to install it. So if you've got a PC, I think you might do it, Andy, you've got a Linux box to do your TeamViewer stuff or whatever. You can then...
that's right.
Yeah, so that's the way we do it like that.
Okay.
So that's Type 2, so...
Okay.
But you obviously... But what's about Hyper-V is that it's... That's what you've got. So you've got your OS level... it looks like it. You think when you install OS, so you've got 2012 R2 onto a physical box, and that's actually running the OS. When you install the Hyper-V layer, so it's a Hyper-V role in it, what it actually does is, it's very, very magical, but it actually makes that base image an actual virtual machine, so you don't actually see that. So that's what Hyper-V in 2012 and 2012 R2 is actually classed as a type 1 virtual machine, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, so, I was going to ask as well a quick side shoot from that. Is when you have these VHDs, what do you do for backup? Do you just back up the VHD as one file?
You can shut them into and back up the VHD, but what I was talking about, the product called Veeam, you might have heard me talk about it. And that's basically back using the VMware or the Hyper-V protocol, not the protocol, but it's like an API that plugs into, and it basically snapshots the machine, and it basically backs up the VHD file using the API to your machine, to the backup server, and then it stops the snapshot once it's backed up that VHD, and then it processes that snapshot into the VHD. That means you then basically got a clean copy of that server to restore if you need to in the future.
Yeah.
I think to explain the concept of snapshots a bit, using a different technology in Linux, what snapshots do is they freeze the initial disk, and then anything, any reads, any writes that happen after that freeze go onto a different, what is the actual snapshot. So it's called copy on write. So anything that's written is copied to this new snapshot. So that's how you guarantee that you get a good image, basically. I think that's how that works.
Yeah, we in Windows there's a thing called VSS, which is, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's like, it's a snapshotting bit in Windows. But what happens with actual, it's a good thing, this is another good thing about virtualization, is you can do snapshots, so don't get confused. What you can do is you can snapshot the hard drive, it then starts writing the data of that hard drive to another hard drive, so you've got two physical files, and what that means is, like, if you wanted to you wanted to put an update on the server, you'd snapshot it, okay? That basically writing all the changes to the hard drive is now going to a new file, okay? And once you finish installing the update and you think it's fine, yeah, that's brilliant. You can then, what you do is you delete the snapshot, and what that does is that process, that puts the data back from the snapshot file back into the original file. But that's brilliant. So you then you're back to where you haven't changed anything because everything worked. But let's say something goes wrong, and you have to restore to that snapshot. Is you say roll back, and I can't remember which way it does, but it basically just rolls the changes back on the hard drive, so that it basically takes you back to before you installed the patch. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does it. As I was just saying, I think it keeps the original image.
Yeah.
And then writes the changes to somewhere else.
Yeah.
Because when you're running an OS, you're constantly writing to the disk and making small changes to the, you know, the memory and the swap file and things like that. So I think when you sort of discard a snapshot, it just takes it back to the original file, if you like.
Yeah, I think it replays the information back into the VHD. Because I think it changed. And what you've got to be careful is what, remember, snapshots aren't a backup. Because you can't take a snapshot and then, like, you can't take a snapshot with the main controller because you don't ever want to roll back the main controller like that. But if you take a snapshot and then someone forgets to take a snapshot, you're going to get two hard drives. So, like, if you leave it for days, you've got to get, like, a 30 gig second file. And it just takes absolutely ages and ages and ages to roll back in to the into the original hard drive, and I've had that happen before with customers doing that. And also, you can be careful where you actually fill up your VMware volume, your data store, when that's happened. So we always set alarms up. So we say, like, if the snapshot gets bigger than a gig or they're older than a day, it sends us alert. So we don't, because we've had too many people get caught by that. Yeah, so that's interesting. We didn't side note about another interesting, brilliant thing about VMware. I'll put a show note, a good YouTube video, which tells you what type 1 and type 2 of Hyper-V. So I talked about VMware, ESXi, and Hyper-V. Microsoft are a bit cunning with their pricings for Hyper-V, and because it's not thing like with Linux thing. So if you buy your licensing, so if you have a server and you buy a data center license in it, you can run as many virtualization. You can, they basically make it free, basically, so you can run as many VMs as you like. So on that machine, so you buy a server with loads of memory, you can run as many virtual servers you can on that hard drive, on that server. Sorry. So that's quite in. So, but I was going to say, but with VMware, it costs a lot more because it's the way it controls it, and you're getting the updates So I've gone about if you've got a standalone host. So if you've got one host, and it's got loads of disks in it. You can put in as many VMs as you want, and all the VMs are stored in the local storage on that machine. What happens if that machine dies? Then all your VHDs and stuff, VMs are stored on that one server, aren't they? So you're going to be a bit stuffed. So you've got a new thing called clustering, which is quite interesting, and where you have your storage somewhere else. So you have a thing called SAN, which is a storage area network, which is really interesting. So you have basically just like a server. Normally it's Linux, but you don't get to see that far because it's all hidden. And it's basically got loads of disks in it with RAID cards in there and stuff. So you basically going things like RAID. You can set your RAID up like you do on your normal server into RAID 5, RAID 10, RAID 50. And what you can then do is that you partition it up to how you like, and you create a thing called a LUN. And you call that, so you create a LUN, and you basically can then present that LUN to your VM host. So say you've got two physical virtualization hosts, let's say running VMware, and you've got your VMware installed on a OS, on an S. So you've got the VMware installed on a SD card. You can then, using, there's two ways you can connect to the SANS. Normally, you've got a thing called Fibre Channel and a thing called iSCSI. So iSCSI is what we're using, is uses over the network. So if you've already got your network already, you've got a nice fast connection, you don't have to worry about doing fibre. The problem you've got is that you're then competing with your networking. So it can be affecting with your traffic. So I would recommend these days 10 gig. 1 gig's not really, is that not up for it. And you normally have that separated either by a separate switch, or you do things, you VLAN the iSCSI traffic out of the way. And then you can, if you've got VLAN and you've got a decent switch, you can put quads on that, which means that the channel, the storage will get a better, will get the priority. Or you can go the fibre way, which is basically using fibre channel, which is basically you have to have HBAs, which is in your servers. HBA is a host bus adapter, and you basically have, you normally have two of those in, if you want, in each server, and they, and they go into, each HBA goes into separate fibre channel switches, and each fibre channel switches goes into your SAN. Normally a SAN has a dual controller, and you kind of make it a mesh so that whatever part fails, you've always got connection to your storage. So if a HBA goes down, you've still got a path to the server. If a SAN, if a fibre switch goes down, you've still got a connection to the storage. And if you've got a controller goes down, then you've still got connection to the storage. Because I haven't really had a SAN go down before. They're very rock solid things. So, and basically, they normally have like a controller, so that they're like in the, normally like in an active way, so that if one goes down, it stays up. So I haven't really ever had a problem with the SAN. And what this is doing, you're basically presenting the storage. So LUN, so you present your LUN, and then if it, depending if you're using iSCSI, you would basically, you basically tell the LUN which servers can access that LUN. And if it's iSCSI, you tell it what the iSCSI name is. It's normally like an FQNDN, which is a fully required domain name. And so basically people to say, you know which server it's coming from. Or is a, in fiber land, you have a thing called Worldwide ID, I think. And you basically, they're the thing that tells you what servers can access that LUN. So you present it to those servers. And when the servers, it's kind of, this all technology
it's a bit like networking. The whole SAN thing, it's a bit like networking. The worldwide name is a bit like a MAC address. And, you know, it all kind of works like that. Just to clarify this a bit, the iSCSI, it's basically like, it's like having a hard drive on the network, isn't it? Directly on the network, no in between bits and bobs.
It's like SCSI commands to get to the hard drive, but instead of going to down the your SCSI card, is going over the iSCSI network to get to the storage, or by fibre channel, it's just doing the same thing but over the fibre channel. And I like fibre channel better because you haven't got any network problems. You haven't got anybody messing about the network or anything. Fibre channel is just purely for
iSCSI. Yeah.
For the storage network, you haven't got anything. And then what happens is when you then present that to, like, present it to present it to VMware, it sees it as a hard drive. And when you add it to the VMware, it basically writes a signature to it. And it basically, that server, the first server what sees it, takes control of it. But because you put a thing called a VMSS, which is VMware File Server, it means that all the servers can share that storage, so it can see those VMs.
Hmm. And so the power of that comes with live migration, I guess, where you can use the same. two separate physical machines can access that one VHD. Yeah. So what that allows you to do is, if one server just dies, you can go over to the other physical server with no loss of service.
Yeah.
So that's the power of it.
Yeah, so you need a thing called, you need a virtual center server or something to control it. So you can download, if you want to, you can download ESXi, and that's free, okay? So I've got that running on my server at home. So what that means is that you install that on the server, and that's free. And the one I've got at home is free. So you can play with it, you kind of thing. But when you want to start doing like virtualization, like a vCenter, is that you have a virtual center, which is basically, it's two ways you can run it. It can be run as a virtual machine, or it can run on a physical server, and it's basically it controls the cluster. So you create a vCenter, and so basically to control VMware, you have a thing called the ESXi client, which is basically a bit of software which you connect to, and you can see your VMware, so you can see your virtual machines. You can see your storage. And it's really interesting. I've never really explained, unless you've actually seen it, which I am, you basically create a virtual machine. You can see the console of that virtual machine, if you see what I mean. So you can go on there, stop and start the virtual machine, like you've actually physically going up to the server and pressing it. You actually right-click on the thing and click on power on, don't you? It's quite cool. And you can right-click it and say open console. Boom, and then you're like getting in front of the...
It's like you're looking at the monitor of the actual virtual machine, isn't it?
Yeah. So with Virtual Center is you point your ESX client to the Virtual Center, and then you add a cluster, you create a cluster, and then you add in your hosts into it. So they're your physical hosts. And then you can, that means you created a cluster. And there's more things you have to do it, but there's things like you set up a thing called a management network and a vMotion network, which basically means basically pushes the traffic. So let's say if you set your cluster up now, which means that if one of your hosts dies, it's like a heartbeat that goes between the two servers, and it goes, hang on, this VM's gone down, I can't contact the host, but I've got my VHD file there, right, I'm going to power that up on the other server. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the other thing as well, is like I was talking earlier, is that if you go to cluster and you have to take a server down for maintenance, there's a thing called vMotion, you can virtually move one machine from one server to the other. And what that does is it basically copies, because as you say, the both machines have got access to the VHDs, it copies over the vMotion network, it copies the memory, because it's basically, I think it puts the memory, it's got like a memory file that's got in the actual, I think it's got like a memory file, like for its virtual memory, like its virtual RAM. It puts it. I think it actually writes it to the actual physical memory, but I think it actually outputs it into a file, and then it puts that. It copies the RAM across the virtual RAM across the network, and then it brings it up on the other server. It's all black magic, but like you can do it without like losing a ping kind of thing. Really good stuff. So
you can be on the server, it can hop from one to another, and you won't even notice.
Yeah.
So pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. If you haven't Googled, just Google it, you're quite cool. So we've gone over my things about talking about the SANs and how they work, the vMotion network. So that's obviously quite expensive to have. That's where the VMware get their money from. But Hyper-V does the same sort of thing. Microsoft does the same sort of thing. But I don't think it's there yet. It's not that good. It's not very nice at all to work with. It's got a lot of catching up to do. For one standalone host, it's fine. But when you start getting clustering, you have to use a thing called Windows Clustering Services. And it uses these files called CSVs to share the files between the servers, and it's really messy. I just don't like how it does things. So you've got like you in Hyper-V to manage it, you have to use something called a Hyper-V manager, okay? And that manages the VMs. The same thing with the ESXi client. You can go in there, stop, start, do snapshots, go to the console, add in hardware and everything. But when you want to copy, the thing is then, right? If you want to be to another virtual machine, you have to use a thing called Failover Manager, which basically which is like another bit of software, which like you have to make a machine highly available. So if you've got a VM in Hyper-V and you want to make it highly available, you have to go into Failover Manager and then enable it to make it highly available. And then you're using Windows clustering, which I'm not that great fan of, and then again, that's fine. That's all included in the price of the product with normal Hyper-V software. But if you want to do the controlling things nice, like from one to a place like you do at VMware, you have to buy a thing called a System Center Virtual Machine Manager, which is really expensive. And that does things like templating and things like that. But it doesn't really, it's just not as nice, not as slick as VMware. Basically.
I guess you've still got to pay for the SAN in that case as well to get the live migration and everything.
Yes.
So yeah.
but VMware Hyper-V do an interesting thing that I've never done with is they do I think it's called something like Hyper-V Replica or something, and if you've got local storage on say you've got two physical hosts with local storage on it, you can actually live migrate the servers using this Hyper-V replica thing, which I haven't actually tried, but I think that's what it's called. So Hyper-V replica is quite a cool thing, which is trying to get money, but it just doesn't feel enterprise ready yet. We've been having an issue with one of our customers with WMI, and it's just horrible. And being with Microsoft, they just get passed between teams. So there's a problem with it. They go, oh, it's WMI, so you're boutique to support WMI issue team, and then they go, no, it's a storage issue, you have to start doing. And they go, oh, no, it's a SCVM problem, you have to go and speak to them. Whereas VMware, you kind of go there and you speak to one person, and they're like there from the whole kind of end to end problem kind of thing. So VMware's definitely a more mature product.
Yeah, they've been going for ages, though. They've been, 10, 15 years now, haven't they?
Yes. So that's thing. And then the other thing as well is a good thing about seeing is you can do things called we were talking about that you've got thin hard drives and then virtual on the SAN as well. You can do things called thin provisioning as well, so you can say, right, I want to give this server 2 terabytes worth of storage, but you don't not actually giving the server 2 terabytes, you just think the server thinks getting 2 terabytes. And then basically when you start creating VHDs on the server, it will just give it server more and more storage as it needs. So it basically means you can over-provision your storage, which is good, because you might start out with, like, let's say you want to have 100 servers and you need 60 gig for each of the servers. You haven't got to buy that storage at the start, because most of that storage is never going to be used, because it's all OS, isn't it? But you do have to keep watching. You have to be very careful of watching your storage, because what you can do is you can easily start running out of hard drives as people start copying files and stuff. But it's just a good way of just getting a SAN into your workplace to start off with, really. The only one less what to talk about is VMware Converter, which is a really cool thing. It's like, so if you've got an old server which is like running 2003 or something, and it's got an application on running an old hardware, you can virtualize that hard drive. So you basically install this bit of software called VMware Converter, stop all the services or anything what's running on that server. You can't do this on the domain controller, but you can do things like SQL or Exchange. You just stop the SQL and Exchange servers, and you basically virtualize. You put the software in, it basically saps or starts pulling all the data out and puts it into VMware. And then you basically, once it's copied all the data across, you shut that physical server down, and you can boot that VM into VMware, and you've got a physical copy or a virtual copy of that server. So it's really good. So
I've used, is it PVM? I think I've used before. Physical to virtual. P2V, was it?
Yeah. P2V, yeah, physical to virtual.
So.
Yeah, cool. Okay, that's cool. Well, that's anything you want to... You're going to talk about Linux side of things regarding it.
I mean, have you got time now?
I've had a text saying that the guys here... I'm going to be doing some work tonight, but the guys just text me saying that they're behind, so...
Okay, that's good for us. Good. Okay. Yeah, so we've been looking at... Like I say, my employer has been on pretty much on bare metal on the Linux side anyway... For up until now, the reason for that being is that it's mostly data processing, so you're dealing with nodes, and there's no point compute nodes, if you like, and there's no point in virtualizing those really. So virtualization has never really been looked at, and it starts to sort of show itself in the way that you have servers, as you were saying, Al. You have servers that are doing one function, and then they've been doing it for 3 years or whatever, the warranty runs out, and all of a sudden you have to commission a new server, install a new server, and get that all going. Whereas if you have it on a virtual machine, the virtual machine stays as it is for however long it needs to, and you swap out the physical hardware underneath it. The issue that we found with Linux virtualization is it's pretty much do-it-yourself. There's all these technologies out there. I mean, like with most things with Linux, it's do it yourself. You find the technologies that you need to do the job, and you kind of glue them together and make them all work together. So the point where we are at the moment is we have got this high availability system using something called DRBD, which is I can't remember what it stands for, but it functions as like a RAID 1 over a network. So you specify two volumes, which are DRBD volumes, and you network you direct connect the two servers that you want to DRBD, and then they synchronize these two volumes between themselves over the network. You don't have to direct connect them, but it's a lot quicker if you do, and a lot less likely to get errors, and it's quicker to sync and everything. So that's how we do high availability at the moment. Then the hypervisor we use is a type 1 hypervisor, going by your description there, Al, called KVM, which stands for Kernel Virtual Module. So it's something that's built directly into the Linux kernel. It runs VMs quite happily. You can control them from the command line, which is great for us Linux guys. And there are kind of front ends built for controlling virtual machines, which sort of more used in the sort of cloud computing space, I think. But the high availability that we're using is called Corosync and Pacemaker, and that basically allows you to pretty much make anything high availability. But obviously we're limited to this two physical server setup at the moment, so I'm not sure how that's going to turn out. But we are going to look at shared file systems, like in the way that VMFS works. There's other Linux technologies using shared file systems. One of them is called Gluster. I looked at that briefly, but I couldn't get it working. That's a sort of work in progress at the moment. But I mean, in other ways, it's pretty much as you've described there. We're looking at using snapshots, but then using another technology called LVM to take snapshots, and that was how I was sort of chipping in about the you sort of freeze the initial disk image, if you like, and then write the changes to a new file, and then you take a backup of that new file. So in that way you can back up your VMs. And yeah, that's really as far as we've got at the moment with virtualization. Another part of the company has been using VMware quite happily for their Windows servers for quite a while now, so they're quite advanced in that respect. But I don't know why we haven't gone with VMware. It's probably to do with their pricing and so on.
Well, you can run Linux. We're running a load of Linux boxes on VMware. Not a problem. It's nice. It's kind of thing. So.
Yeah. I mean, we had one actually. I wanted to have more, but didn't happen. Then someone else in my team was looking at VMware, and I think it just fell over because they're trying to do a licensing deal with, because they're a massive company, they're trying to do a licensing deal with VMware, and it's just taking ages. So yeah. We've gone with the Linux do-it-yourself.
DRBD is distributed replicated block device.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, distributing or mirroring a hard drive over the network.
Yeah.
And you can do kind of live migration type thing with that, where you normally have it in an active-passive mode, where the server running the VM is active and the server that isn't is passive. And you have alternating VMs, if you like. So you have, say, VM1 and VM3 active on one node, and then VM2 and VM4 active on the other node. So you alternate the VMs between physical servers. And then, so if you need to take one physical server down, you just migrate all the VMs over to one. And for that bit, you can make both the DRBD volumes active. So you get that live migration thing going with the high availability. So that's in a nutshell, that's where we've got to.
So, but I'm guessing things like people do it, the thing that, like, all these virtual, like, DigitalOcean and stuff, they all must use some sort of KVM or something, don't they? They must use something along that lines to.
There is this thing called OpenStack in the open source world, where it's kind of a framework for building up virtualization clusters, if you like, and you have all these different aspects, like you have this object storage engine and, you know, virtualization engine, and then you can use many different, because there are lots of different hypervisors in Linux that you can choose from, and it's kind of a framework to make them all work together and just use it in that way. But yeah, I think a lot of people are using a lot of different things and experimenting, and that's where the whole sort of cloud computing thing came from, I think.
Yeah, I would like to know more about that, but it's just seemed like a massive project to learn. Didn't we meet a guy Oddcamp, he got really excited when we started talking about OpenStack or whatever. He was on about something, wasn't he?
Was he on about Juju, which... That seems to be like a configuration management type thing, but only for Ubuntu. Yeah. It did look pretty whizzy. I quite liked the way you could just... It's kind of, you could do building blocks and it worked out all the stuff underneath. That was quite cool.
So have you actually got KVM working then? And on a machine then?
KVM itself is really easy to get going. The configuration of the virtual machine is just an XML file. So you specify the processor, number of processors, amount of memory and all the rest of it. And it's just an XML file, and then the kernel knows exactly what to do with that, and you just say...
How do you get to the console of it then on the next machine?
There's a thing called Virt Manager. Now, this is a kind of a separate topic. There's a library in Linux called libvirt, which can interface with all these different hypervisors. So you run Virt Manager, and it can show you all your virtual machines that are running on that machine, and then you can double-click on it, and it brings up the console. I think it uses, again, it's using all these different technologies underneath. I think it uses VNC to achieve that.
Oh, okay.
So, but yeah, that's pretty cool. But I mean, you don't get access to all the features to really, as with everything with Linux, to get all the features, you have to go into the command line and muck around there. But, I mean, even then, you do get quite nice tools on the command line. You don't have to go into too much detail and that. So, yeah, it's good. It's all very interesting anyway. So, again, it's new stuff. That kind of makes it interesting. So.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point to stop there anyway. We can talk about things more later on. But I've always quite interested in that KVM kind of thing. Because, I mean, like, I know a couple of people who run a couple of virtualization companies out there, and they use something like KVM, I think, or there might be Xen, actually, they're using. Is Xen or something as well, isn't there, you can use?
Yeah, Amazon uses Xen. I think they funded it loads, and their EC2 stuff is all built on Xen. So, yeah, that's a big one. But using libvirt, you can control Xen virtual machines or whatever. Mm-hmm. So all it really is the format of how you describe the virtual machine and the disk format. That's the only real difference in how it all works, really.
Cool. So we've actually got a Facebook page now, haven't we? After someone's didn't tell about it last time. So I've created a Facebook page. So, yeah. You can find it at facebook.com/admin podcast. So go along there and like us, and whenever the new show out, we'll publish it, or if it's finding interesting, we'll publish it on there. So I'm guessing it's a Twitter account, I'm guessing, what we might have to get again. Yeah. But again, we've got the issue where they don't have you can only have so many characters. So
for the handle?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Admin Podcast is too long, I think. So
I still think we should go for AAPC.
Yeah.
You know, as a tribute to UUPC, the Ubuntu podcast.
Good. All right. Well, we might as well get. I've had a text and saying they've done. So.
Okay.
So. Cool. Okay. All right. If you want emails, you can email us at mail@admin podcast.co.uk. Any final words, guys? Andy?
Just to let everyone know, we don't know yet, but the quality of the recording might be slightly different today. We've had to do a backup recording of it, so yeah. Just in case everyone thinks it sounds a bit different from normal, we should be back to normal next week.
Yeah, a few technical difficulties on my end. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so we're just going to grab the audio a different way. So, but hopefully it won't turn out that bad, and you won't even notice. Mm. So,
you can edit that bit out then.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So so if that's everything, we'll see everyone next week.
Bye.
See you later, guys. Bye.